This summer, saddle up with the only sportsbook where you can bet on horse racing, FanDuel. Right now, new customers can get a no-sweat first bet up to $500. That's right, you'll get up to $500 back in racing credit if your first horse racing bet doesn't win. With FanDuel Sportsbook, you can even watch and bet select races live right in the app. So, bet horse racing on the same app where you bet all your other favorite sports. FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook. Just download the app or go to FanDuel.com/horses to score your no-sweat bet up to $500. 21 plus and present in Ohio. Offer valid on first real money wager of $5 or more. Verified FD racing account required. Bonus issued in non-withdrawable racing site credit that expires 7 days after issuance. Max refund $500. Restrictions apply. See terms at racing.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
My panel in studio this morning: Lise Hand, political columnist and commentator at Hack for Hire, journalist at large.
Journalist at large
will do. Good morning, Lise. How are you?
Good morning.
Professor Gary Murphy is the head of School of Law and Government at DCU. Good morning, Gary.
Hi, Gavin.
And Stephen O'Leary is a social media analyst at Alitico, which is an online news and social media monitoring and analysis company, and a lecturer in online journalism at Griffith College, which means he must have very long business cards. Good morning, Stephen. How are you?
Good morning, Gavin.
Thank you all for coming in to be with us this morning. Let's take a look at what's on the front pages of the newspapers. We'll start with the Sunday Independent. Fine Gael inquiry set to name Bailey swing case source. Philip Ryan tells us that the internal Fine Gael inquiry into Maria Bailey's personal injury claim against a Dublin hotel over all the stuff that you know, has learnt that barrister David Kennedy, who's leading the investigation, will draw conclusions on where he believes court documents relating to the case may have been acquired by the Irish Independent. To be honest, don't know why it's relevant in all honesty. Also on the front page of the Sunday Independent, first social media controls revealed. Samantha McCochran, the business editor, says that an Irish regulatory watchdog which will police all video content on the world's biggest social media platforms. I'm just going to repeat that sentence. An Irish regulatory watchdog which will police all video content on the world's biggest social media platforms has set out the new powers it will use to combat harmful video content online. The Broadcasting Authority of Ireland, which currently regulates Irish commercial radio and television, including this station, as well as TG Cathair and RTE, will now regulate video content on Facebook, Twitter and YouTube in Ireland and across Europe. As the world's largest social media platforms are based in Ireland, the BAI will now be able to expand its reach across the continent and be responsible for most rules for most video content on social media sites. I have some serious problems with that idea, but we might get back to that in a couple of minutes' time. Front page of the Sunday Times, meanwhile. Boris Johnson, a security risk over private life. Security risk there is in inverted commas. Tip Shipman, who is the political editor of the British edition, has written this story. The Tory leadership contest erupted in acrimony last night as Jeremy Hunt said Boris Johnson did not deserve to lead unless he could answer questions about his character. Cabinet allies of Hunt claimed that Johnson's colourful private life meant he was a security risk and vulnerable to blackmail from foreign powers. The British Foreign Secretary rounded on his predecessor Johnson last night after police were called to the flat the front runner shares with his girlfriend Carrie Simmons after an explosive row in the early hours of Friday. Johnson refused four times to explain what happened as the contenders to be the next Prime Minister faced off at the first of 16 hustings yesterday. To be honest, I'm not sure if his private life means that he's a security risk so much as the fact that he continually used to take holidays while he was Mayor of London at a villa owned by the media mogul who owns the Independent newspaper, but that's a totally different, I mean the British Independent newspaper, lest anyone think that there's a cross wires. Also on the front of the Sunday Times, Google links show school of creational murderers. Google's related searches service is providing people who type in the name of Boy A and the town that he lives with the name of the school that he and Boy B attended. The two boys were found guilty last week of the murder of Annie Creational, the 14-year-old schoolgirl, while Boy A was also found guilty of violent sexual assault. We'll be returning to that theme in just a few moments as well. But meanwhile, on the front of the Sunday Business Post, the United Nations enters a row over the state's official figures for asylum seekers. Ireland's asylum seeker statistics bear no relation to reality, a leading UN agency has claimed. The Department of Justice's official statistics show that it granted asylum to 85% of people whose applications were processed last year. That was the highest approval rate for asylum applications across the EU in 2018, which portrays Ireland as the state with the most open asylum policy. But the UN High Commissioner on Refugees says that these figures bear no relation to the actual number of successful applications. It has told the Sunday Business Post that the percentage of positive decisions in asylum seeker applications last year was not around 85%, as the Department of Justice claims, but rather around 30%. So interesting to see exactly how those two figures managed to sit side by side. Front page of the Irish Mail on Sunday. Dine with the Minister for €600 per head. Fine Gael hosted an exclusive fundraising dinner with some of the country's leading barristers in Dublin on Friday night. The Irish Mail on Sunday can reveal it's estimated that the dinner, where Justice Minister Charlie Flanagan made a speech, raised about €25,000, as speculation intensifies that the party is preparing to boost its war chest for an early general election. Also mentioned on that story inside is the fact that Fine Gael ministers held what's referred to as a pre-cabinet meeting a few weeks ago, where the only topic of discussion was whether there should be an early election. And the paper tells us, in a piece written by John Drennan, John Lee and Craig Hughes, that Fine Gael ministers were not agreed on whether they should have one or not. So it seems that this paralysis is really taking its toll on the government party. And finally, the front page of the Sunday World, Kinahan's €1 billion coke bust. €1 billion coke bust. Cartel linked to record-breaking seizure on a Philadelphia ship. US feds alerted Gardaí gang's cargo was headed for the Irish market. So that's just a little taster of what's on the front page of the Sunday newspapers. Lee's Hand, Professor Gary Murphy and Stephen O'Leary with me. Lee's, before we talk about media filtering and content and regulation of all of this, you're very good to come into us because, as your introduction alluded there, it's been a difficult week for yourself and everyone else who was on the payroll at the now late and lamented Irish edition of The Times.
Yes, absolutely. We printed our last edition yesterday, and the bulk of the 20 staff that were employed there as journalists and subs and so on are now no longer. There is still a presence there. Mm. There are still three journalists who will run a kind of a skeleton operation, so, you know, keep an Irish presence there. But the product as we know it, yeah, is kaput. And it was a shock to us all. I mean, in a PH, I was almost like a PG Wodehouse kind of, you know, black surreal yeah. humour moment.
I've never had you portrayed as much of a Jeeves.
Well, there you go. Well, I mean, it was just something when the actual news broke that that the operation was going to cease. Mm. When I actually got the message, I was standing about, I'd say, less than a foot away from Prince Charles down in Glendalough when on his visit. So I'm literally sort of standing at the elbow of the heir to the British throne and getting a message saying, you know, your job's gone. So, it kind of sort of sums up the sort of slightly chaotic, you know, nature of our gig, really, you know. But yeah, you know, I mean, it is a real shame because it wasn't really that, you know, the project failed. It was really just a combination of, you know, just journalism is in a bad place at the moment, print journalism particularly. The print edition was beginning to, you know, pick up sales, and we had a really good online, you know, we had decent online subscriptions, and you know, and a really good team. And, you know, the Times Ireland edition were, you know, genuinely breaking stories. There was a very young team there, a lot of talent, and, you know, had been nurtured very much by Richie Oakley, the editor. And, you know, there was some groundbreaking journalism, you know, happening. I mean, I suppose the proof in that particular pudding is other media organisations kept trying to rob our staff, which is always a sign that we're doing something right. So, but yeah, you know, it is a sad week. And I think everybody felt very sad on Friday when, you know, the final edition went to print.
Yeah. Stephen O'Leary, as someone who observes the media industry for a living, what does it tell us about the state of print media in general that a paper which, as Lee's correctly says, really did have its impact and really seemed to punch above its weight for so long, didn't manage to make the commercial inroads that its proprietors seem to think it needed?
Yeah, and it's the commercial inroads is the key line in that for me. It's trying to come up with a model where you can blend your print and your online editions and find a way to make this type of journalism profitable. I mean, you know, in a week in which, you know, there was a real standout moment in terms of, I guess, kind of court or legal reporting. And it was the long form piece in the Irish Times that was published. Conor Gallagher, I think, had the piece, and the conversation online after that piece was published. Mm. There was this universal sentiment that we need journalism and we need to be paying for journalism. And this is, his article was held up as an example of why we need it. You know, this was an hour long read. When you go online, they tell you how long it's going to take
74 minutes or something.
Yeah. 16,000 words.
Yeah. But a cracking hour as well. It's a wonderful read.
It's an
incredible
read.
Piece. But it for me, it kind of, the connection to the Times Ireland in terms of this as a piece of journalism is that there is an absolute need for this type of journalism, and there's a need to be paying for this type of journalism. But there is an onus on news organisations to come up with a model that will work too. I think that piece by Gallagher was a really good example of something that people would have paid for, and they would have paid, you know, a premium for a piece of journalism like that. And it's, how do you get that right? How do you do as a news organization? Do you manage to charge for the online edition of that in a way, you know, whether it's a pay by article model as opposed to a subscription? But there needs to be more experimentation in the space.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting topic. Gary, any thoughts on the general lay of the land?
Yeah, I think the problem is that very few people are now buying newspapers for news, because they know the news already from the web.
So they want a views paper.
Pretty much, I think. You know, I had a subscription, which I think I'll now let drop for the Times Ireland, because the first thing I always go to, of course, is the sports pages. And the Times Ireland sports was fantastic. People like Tommy Conlon,
great sports team
Siggins,
there.
Gary Doyle.
Yeah. It was Enda tremendous McAvoy. Sport.
Enda, who I know for a long time and torments me about Cork hurling. But I think that's
as a Kilkenny man would.
Indeed. Yeah. But I think that's the problem. And I don't think it has been... it has, as Stephen said, you know, that dichotomy between online and print and paying hasn't been solved yet. But newspaper circulations have collapsed over the course of the last two decades with the prevalence of the web. And while I'm not convinced that that can be solved, really, people do want to pay for journalism, and many of us do. I buy, you know, three or four papers a day practically, and you know, I need to do it for work as well. You know, if you want to comment on sort of modern Irish politics, but the average person doesn't, of course. And if you can just go to Google and find stuff on the web, you know, you're very, very unlikely to pay for it.
But yeah, and I think that actually the Conor Gallagher is a great example, because it's also about, you know, somebody, you know, trusting a journalist who's professional, who, you know, Conor was at that trial every day, and that made the difference. So he wasn't just sort of, you know, a commentator. He wasn't just, you know, sort of sitting at home reading the sort of, you know, coverage from other papers. He was down there. What he wrote was his own person, you know, his own experience. And then as an experienced professional journalist, he was able to put it together. People knew his byline because he's reported on other trials before. So it's trying to find, you know, that sort of nexus between journalists who are, you know, who know how to do their job properly, who can write well, but who also have the time and are given the time to actually cover these things properly and comprehensively, and then, you know, write it. How you get people to understand that, you know, that doesn't, it's a bit like the old argument about water, you know, it doesn't just fall out of the sky and into your tap. Neither does journalism.
Well, on that point though, and I don't disagree at all that the Conor Gallagher piece, if we're going to use that as the exemplar, was a phenomenal piece, but I don't know, I didn't happen to see the print copy of the Irish Times the following day, but I don't know whether they committed those 16,000 words to print. But it would strike me that there could be a balance to be struck by saying that Conor Gallagher is a wonderful journalist who knows inside out the field that he does, who was given the resources to attend that trial every single day. But the Irish Times could have put the piece in print the following day and charged people to pick it up at a newsstand and read it, rather than putting it up for free, where it got a huge audience, and rightly so, but didn't make much money for the Irish Times as a result.
16,000 words in a would be like a full pull-out supplement. I mean, you couldn't really fit 16,000 words in just into the sort of the paper.
They gave it two pages.
But two pages would be a truncated version of it.
And its job too, in some ways, like as kind of a marquee piece, it's a bit like, you know, Fintan O'Toole's piece last year, where they actually brought down the paywall on his article about the rise of fascism because of the amount of coverage it was getting and the appetite for it. That really put, I would imagine, introduced the Irish Times to a new audience. I would imagine Gallagher's piece did a similar job, that there will be people now, the hope would be that there are people who are taking out subscriptions or buying that paper more often, purely on the back of that one piece that they made available.
That's a fair point and a fair counterpoint. Stephen, I want to come back to you about the story that I mentioned on the front page of the Sunday Independent, this idea that the BAI, I should clarify, by the way, that in the first few paragraphs of that story that I read by Samantha McCochrane, who's the business editor of the Sunday Business Post, what I didn't get to read out is that the BAI have made these proposals to government. It's not exactly set in stone yet that the BAI would be the regulator, but the BAI, she explains, wants to become an enlarged media commission. And maybe, Stephen, I'm thinking too academically about this, but to my mind, as someone who's worked in the broadcast sector for a few years, the BAI is there to regulate what broadcasters say, because broadcasters can't broadcast without borrowing the public airwaves, so that there is a natural reason why you have to be regulated in a slightly different degree to which newspapers or other media are regulated. And it doesn't strike me as being the BAI's wheelhouse to start then suddenly becoming a media regulator for basically for the entirety of the internet, almost for the entirety of the world.
But there's a more fundamental question here, and that is the practicalities of what the BAI is setting out to do. You know, it is one thing.
Which is to become some sort of a watchdog for the entirety of all video content on all media platforms around the world.
Ever. I mean, it's just, look, the ambition is admirable. And there's no question that this is a week in which there has been a real focus on what gets published on social networks.
Sure.
And how we talk online. So it's no surprise to see a topic like this coming up. But really, for me, this is far less about regulation. And I think the regulation of this is, you know, we saw this through the courts this week. It's a near impossible job. But technology has a huge role to play. And one of the key pieces in all of the coverage around the regulation of online content that we've seen this week was the point that the DPP made. And they were particularly critical when both Twitter and Facebook were brought to court this week about the fact that Twitter were reactive, whereas Facebook were being proactive.
Yes.
And this came down to the video content and the regulation of video content and information that was being posted online. You know, they made the point that Facebook had taken these steps at the onset of some legal cases in the last couple of months,
yeah,
where they sought information, they sought imagery, they sought names, they sought things that they could put in as blocks, so that at the point at which a user decided they were going to post something online, Facebook would prevent it ever going up,
yeah,
in the first place. And I think for me, what I would like to see is, if this is proprietary technology, and I have no idea if it is or not, but if it is, it really feels that it's the kind of technology that should be made open source, because the benefit to, and I don't want to sound too kind of high and grand here, but the benefit to society of the technology to preemptively,
yes,
stop content,
yeah,
being published is significant. And I think it should apply to all social networks,
yeah,
across the world.
Maybe it's actually something that one of those university hothouses could actually nurture, because it sounds like the sort of thing which could become increasingly more lucrative as well as societally useful.
I think the problem is... Reading Samantha's piece where she talks about the rules will require age verification, parental controls and a robust complaints mechanism, according to BAI proposals.
Mm.
But I mean, how would that robust complaints mechanism work if it's for the whole of the internet? I mean, are they just going to like massively up staff with, you know, because how would it work? Yeah. I mean, you could just have literally thousands and thousands of complaints for one piece that someone's...
Yeah.
Wandered across, you know, Googling one night. I mean, it seems a bit unrealistic, to be frank.
Considering the problems that we've had before, not so much these days, but the problems we've had before with the understaffing of the Data Protection Commissioner, who once upon a time was based over a centre in Port Arlington and responsible for pretty much the entire global regulation of Facebook and Twitter.
Do you remember during the collapse of the Fitzpatrick trial a couple of years ago, there was complaints that the Office of Director of Corporate Enforcement had been routinely underfunded for a couple of decades? And,
yeah,
you know, the lamented Bertie Ahern said it would just have to wait its turn in the queue to be upstaffed during the boom years. So, I mean, the state's not very good at this thing, really.
Don't know if that might be the first time in a while that Bertie's been described as lamented in this programme. Lise Hand, I want to come at you, not specifically about the role of the BAI, if that's the role they want to take on, but it seems that a couple of the topics are being conflated in how we approach all of this, and we obviously have to be very careful about how we approach this in ourselves in studio right now. But in one angle, people are coming at it from the perspective that it is illegal to name Boy A and Boy B, and as Stephen has mentioned, some networks have been much more proactive about trying to ensure that is upheld than others. But then there's the parallel debate, in which this is the one that really took fire in the Dáil this week, about whether under 18s should have free access to all of the content that's out there in the world, irrespective of how family friendly or adult in nature that it might be. And that we need to be careful that we have two debates independently and not just throw the whole thing into one big muddle, because muddled questions lead to muddled answers.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think the two issues have become conflated. I suppose the Anna Creagill trial was sort of the perfect storm in a way, because it brought in the whole question of, you know, anonymity for, for underage people who are, you know, up before the courts. It also brought into question then the whole issue of, you know, young people having access to you know, adult sites, to porn. It brought it, like, an awful lot of things happened around, swirled around this trial. And, you know, you, on one hand, you saw, you know, the efforts to try and keep, keep a lid on the identities and so on, and the massive struggle that was. But then you also had this, as you say, this other debate about, you know, okay, fine, if you put clamps on everything, you know, what does that actually mean in terms of restricting, you know, people's access and young people's access, is it right to take that away? And, you know, I think one of the things in the trial that shocked, of the many things that sort of was a piece of evidence that came out that shocked people in this trial, was the fact that Boye had been, you know, consuming, there was so much pornographic matter found on his phones. And I think this sort of raised that debate. And, you know, it's a tricky one, because I think that there's one piece, one of the pieces, I think, in Sunday Business Post, the writer was making the point that, you know, when we were kids, if your mum and dad wanted to know where you at, they opened the back door and said, you know, who's he playing with? And, you know, come in and your dinner's ready. Whereas now there's this sort of vast hinterland of, you know, of stuff that, and parents just genuinely don't really know and understand, you know, where their kids are at. And I think something, you know, it's easy to sort of wring your hands and say, oh, somebody should do something about that. But, you know, you wouldn't let your kids wander off with a pile of strangers and not know what they're at, you know. So,
but if everyone says someone should do something, then what is the something that we should do? Because, Stephen, the idea that was floated in the door this week and Niamh Radcliffe didn't immediately shoot it down was the idea of replicating Britain's what's become informally known as the porn block, where effectively all adult sites are gated communities and you have to be able to prove your age. You're already shaking your head thinking that that's unworkable.
It's the practicalities again. I think, and again, with the greatest respect to our politicians, I think it betrays an element of like naivety in terms of how this type of technology works, and essentially how young people in general are able to bypass most any blocks or stops that are in place. Certainly if it's a case of saying, please state your age. I mean, you know, if you're 12 or 13 and you want to access something that says, well, are you over 18? I mean, what 12 or 13 year old is going to say, oh, well, actually, I'm 12 or 13. So there's the practicalities of this, but it also, I think it misses the point in terms of where responsibility can be taken. And I'm, you know, as a new parent, I'm very careful to kind of, you know, I suppose be mindful of the responsibilities that parents have. But I do think there's a huge case for education here. And the education not just of young people in relation to technology, pornography, and a whole bunch of other things that have come out in the nature of a case like this, but also the education of parents. You know, I fully appreciate that technology is changing rapidly. And that there will be parents who don't understand nearly as much about technology as perhaps their children do. But there has to be the resources and the education in place to help parents to have conversations with their children about technology and about the kind of things that are coming through.
There's an interesting piece, sorry Gavin, by Jim Daly.
Yeah, I was going to come to you about it.
Yeah,
Jim wants some sort of mandatory system where you'd have to have some semi-formal regulation or regulation of age.
He basically wants a sort of an age identification code. He's the Minister for Safety for Older People and Mental Health, but to be fair, at least he's thinking about it. I'm not sure how it would work, and he might benefit from talking to Stephen, but I mean, at least he's making some effort. But kids are so tech savvy these days. They're you know, accessing smartphones at a very relatively young age, and they know far more about them than people like ministers for state.
Stephen, is that a feasible idea at all? Jim Daly's idea of having some semi-state organised age registration facility.
Well, look, I mean, I suppose the comparison that's often made is sort of the availability of alcohol, you know, and so if you want to get alcohol from an off licence and you're under the age of 18, you know, I don't need to list the ways on the airwaves that under 18s go about.
But they
come up with ways around it.
They do.
And so if they don't have an official card or code, they find other ways to do it. So I think for me, I would much rather in a situation like that parents are talking to their kids about alcohol and about its effect and about what happens, rather than saying you are banned and find a way around it.
Yeah. But if the government were going to bring something, you know, like this, they probably have a window to do it when people are still, the memories of what's gone on in the recent weeks are fresh in the mind, because there generally tends to be a natural pushback by members of the general public, and correctly, when any mutterings start coming from government about ID cards, you know, having to submit information, there's an automatic pushback. So there probably is a window now when people really want to talk about this, and want to talk it through, that if they were going to get proactive about it, it's probably the time to do it is now.
Yeah, that maybe to strike while the iron is hot. And I know that not everyone is wild about Jim Daly's idea, but at least to his credit, he is proposing a solution and allowing people to debate it.
And he makes the point that, you know, we should be sort of pioneers, and we shouldn't wait for the rest of the world. We should do something about it. But to be fair, I think
we're required to be, because we are the EU's tech home, basically, aren't we?
Apparently so.
I don't think they want to hear about that kind of thing. Unless I'm wrong. I think what they want to hear is what my plans are for the country and for our party.
Not sure if everyone necessarily agrees with that, because if you look at the front page of the Sunday Express today in Britain, the splash, "Why won't Boris tell us what happened?" And the Sunday Express would not be known as a publication too hostile to Boris Johnson or his general stance on matters EU. The Sunday Mirror, "Boris row was so frightening I had to call police." The Sunday Telegraph, "Left-wing neighbours admit taping Boris row." Well, duh, because I don't think the recording made its way into The Guardian by someone, you know, apparating it in front of someone else. The Sunday Times leads with, "Boris is a security risk," which we mentioned. And the Mail on Sunday, "Bust up Boris, hit by shock poll blow." He was 8 points ahead of Jeremy Hunt before that report of the domestic on Thursday night, Friday morning. He is now 3 to 5 points behind. The Observer, by the way. "Johnson under fire over row with partner as far-right link is revealed," which is a link to Steve Bannon, who has now taken Boris on as something of a project slash client. I don't know about any of my three panelists, Stephen O'Leary, Lee's Hand and Gary Murphy, but I'm a little bit perturbed by the response of Boris Johnson, or rather all of his surrogates, to the reporting of the domestic row that he had on Thursday night, Friday morning. Gary, I'll start with you on this, where the general tenor of the reporting seems to be, or the response seems to be, yeah, well, you know, his neighbours are, you know, Labour voters, or they're anti-Brexiteers, they're lefties, they read The Guardian, so of course they're going to report a man for what might be a very serious domestic incident. Like, it's just like, are we going to start discounting all calls to 999 on the basis of what your stance on Brexit was?
Well, or the basis that you're a public figure. I mean, the idea that you wouldn't ring up the police because it's a public figure involved, maybe the most famous public figure in Britain, seems to me quite ludicrous, you know, as anyone who's looked at the, you know, the domestic violence figures, both in Ireland, Britain, all across the Western world over the past decade. I mean, this is a huge issue for mankind, and I say fair play to them for doing it. Whether they're remainers, leavers, whatever, it seems to me is beside the point. I mean, Jeremy Hunt in his letter to Boris carefully disguised the character issue, but brought up as well, you know, that the people want to know our policies and our character.
Yeah.
And but Boris is a bit like Trump, you know, kind of a clean-cut version of Trump, but it seems slightly immune, his past character, which is given all its lurid detail in the Sunday Times today, where there's a for and against piece by two of his biographers. But it is quite something else. And, you know, this reminds me in many ways of going back three decades when Margaret Thatcher went, and the assumption was Michael Heseltine would win the Tory leadership in a landslide. And of course, John Major, the great grey man of British politics, came on the outside and won, and played an important role, as we know, in the peace process here in Ireland. And Boris could potentially lose. I mean, I was thinking, how might he lose? And unless there was some enormous shock. And this is clearly, the Telegraph, of course, is hopelessly compromised by the fact that they pay him, what's it, £375,000
a year to write a column. Yeah.
But to jot out something he says he writes on Saturday morning early before he goes to work, which I'm not sure how they felt about that.
He says he can churn out the 1,100 words in 2.5 hours, which strikes me as someone who writes about that length for a weekly column for a local newspaper. It kills me. Like, I'd never get it churned out in 2.5 hours. I don't know how long it might take you to put words on a page, whether you could turn it around in 2.5 hours.
Well, I mean, I have done, but generally because I'm sort of, you know, I've been thinking about it for a couple of days. You know, I don't just sort of, you know, bumble in, sit down, scratch my head, scream at my plant, which apparently he used to do. He used to have these mad screaming sessions.
Maybe that's what it was on Thursday night. He would just shout at the plant instead of his
partner.
Yeah,
he would literally scream at his plant to try and work himself up in order to actually write the columns, which I thought was quite extraordinary.
Okay.
You know,
what do you do? How do you get motivated when you're trying to get the creative juices flowing?
I generally just wait until the news editor has rung, going, "Where's your copy?"
Yeah.
And, you know, and I'm going, I'm just finishing it when I'm actually just firing up a blank page.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I can say that now because, you know, obviously been busted now is fine.
What I'll also reveal there, but before you end up in the employ of someone else, is that the nickname that you used to have among me and a few other people in Leinster House was Lee's Three Words Hand, because I know a former colleague of ours who would share an office with you, who would leave you at lunchtime. They'd say, "You coming for lunch?" And you'd say, no, I need to get working on this." And they would come back and you would have written three words, and the three words were...
"By Lee's hand."
By Lee's hand. On a serious note, Stephen, do you think the fallout from this Boris Johnson incident on Thursday night, Friday morning, it appears to have had a very short-term impact on at least one opinion poll, but do you think that in the grand scheme of things, the Tory electorate will care all that much about Boris Johnson's private life, considering they've known for a while that he's had two failed marriages and that it's not even clear how many children he has?
Yeah, I think the audience in the Sky TV debate yesterday... are evidence that no is the answer there. You heard the cheering and the the moderator in that interview yesterday too was booed by the audience as he pursued that line of questioning for the second or third time, and so eventually kind of moved on. I also think there's a really important point we need to make here in terms of how the media are reporting this and some of the commentary around it, and the difference between calling 999 to report an incident, for which I think there is widespread support, from what I've read.
Irrespective of how you voted on Brexit.
Precisely. But then giving that recording, or giving a recording you've made, to the press. And they are two very, very different things here. And again, I'm not passing judgment on either, but I do think that we need to be careful about the two. So I don't think there is any, kind of moment in the reporting that I've looked at where it's kind of said, well, the call should never be made. I think there is widespread support for those calls to always be made. But I do think that there is a question about when someone then has a recording that they have that they used, you know, at the time, what they decide to do with it. And, you know, if you do give that to the press, then I think you can probably expect the newspapers on either side the following days to come and say, well, okay, well, you've given this to the press. That was, you didn't have to do that. Well, that wasn't part of the, you know, the public good or the reporting side of things. So where is this going?
Well, that's the important point, isn't it, Lise? Because I don't think anyone would argue with the idea of calling the police if you're genuinely concerned about the welfare of the people on the other side of the door. But it is the act of perceived political sabotage by then, you know, knowingly leaking it to a newspaper as well, is what some people find a bit distasteful.
Yeah, well, it's particularly in this sort of heightened political atmosphere where, you know, it is everything is so polarised with regards to Brexit at the moment as well. So every gesture takes on this sort of is magnified. Now, you know, it's just the luck of the dice that the, you know, Boris's neighbours, next door neighbours happen to be, you know, Remainers. And I think if they, you know, they'd obviously record it, which I think actually, you know, recording, they, you know, having a recording of a row, I could understand why that's perfectly understandable, because if you were, say, required to give evidence, if something, if you know, a domestic had turned into something more serious, you know, you would want maybe audio to back up, you know, you, if you're the ones that rang. But it's, you know, it's just that the atmosphere is so febrile. And I mean, I think the other point to remember is that Boris will be selected Prime Minister, essentially, not by the general public, but by the voting public, but by the
Tory members.
Like a Tory membership, which is basically, you know, mostly middle-aged white and seems to be predominantly, absolutely, adamantly pro-Brexit. And there's a bit of an element of, you know, let's the Tory membership, let's just get, you know, a Brexiteer in and then we'll deal with the other stuff afterwards. You know, there is a sort of, you know, there is an element of that. And, you know, there is, you do keep going back to the sort of the Trump comparisons, because I was struck just reading, and now she is Sonia Purnell in the Sunday Times today. She was writing an Against Boris piece.
Yeah.
She'd experienced working with them. But her just description, you know, she says, Boris Johnson can change from bonhomie to a dark fury in seconds. His normally jokey demeanour flashes into a sarcastic snarl. His skin reddens and blotches. His eyes dart into an intense, narrow glare. And on the worst occasions, his lips curl to reveal wisps of spittle. Now, that's pretty grim.
Yeah.
But if you had read a lot of the insider reports talking about Trump's, you know, mercurial changes of mood and flashes of temper, if you've read, I'm just halfway through Under Siege, the follow-up book to Fire and Fury written by Michael Wolff. And, you know, and then you have the chaotic private life, the absolute inability to make up hit their mind on one thing or the other. They could switch, you know, they could switch from one policy to another in the blink of an eye. The sort of the shape-shifting chameleon nature of what they stand for and believe in.
Yeah.
You know, so you have basically going back, looping back to the original point, is it sort of a case of let's make Brexit great again and just get our man in and over the line and then we can deal with the other stuff afterwards. So,
there's a great story on page 9 of the Sunday Times, just across from that, Sonia Purnell piece, Tory MPs plotting to make Boris a PM for just one day.
That's a cracking story,
by Tim Shipton.
How's that going to work?
How it's going to work is that basically a few Remainers are going to defect. And, you know, then there'll be a vote of no confidence issued by Jeremy Corbyn, we assume, and that he'll be taken down within a day. Now, this could spark a constitutional crisis because the Queen mightn't actually allow him to go
for... Yeah, because doesn't the parting Prime Minister, Theresa May in this case, has to be able to recommend to the Queen someone who she believes
she
can command the confidence,
and
which Boris Johnson
may not
be able to do.
Obsessed about bringing the Queen into politics, which would be a terrible thing to have to happen.
It's the only part missing in this mad story. I mean, like, really... dragging the Queen into it is the only thing that actually hasn't happened so far.
Well,
so
what I think is remarkable about that story, about the whole idea of there being defectors, is that Theresa May, for all of her faults, did somehow, partly by not making any coherent decisions, but did manage to keep the broad Tory church together. And then on day one of Boris Johnson being in there, people resigning and defecting and suddenly not being able to actually run the country
I'd
at all.
I'd probably be completely wrong, but I still think there is a chance Jeremy Hunt could do quite well. I mean, he really is a good old-fashioned sort of Macmillan Tory. He's like of the Tory family, as you know, his parents were high Tories, and you know, he's got the entrepreneurial sort of background, although not very successful if one reads closely about him.
I think the money is really important here too.
Yeah.
There has been reports in the last couple of days about what will happen amongst the big Tory donors if Johnson gets in, and a few of them have come out and said, we'll stop donating. So as much as there is kind of, you know, the political side of this, I think the economic side is one to keep an eye on too, because I think that could play an important role in terms of seeing whether or not this is a true fight.
He looks and acts like a Tory, where Johnson sometimes doesn't. And I think Johnson isn't really a true Brexiteer. We all know about the famous, you know, two columns Johnson, where he decided, wrote one for pro and one for to leave back in 2016.
Depending on which way the plant had clearly argued him before he filed
it. He's probably the only person who could presumably get away with saying, oh, things have changed now that I'm Prime Minister and we have to do a deal and we'll extend it if needs be.
They're not exactly rolling the red carpet out from in Europe. And, you know, the European leaders seem to be regarding his potential arrival with like less than, you know, overwhelming enthusiasm as well. So, you know, he might find a chilly welcome if he does go there and trying to renegotiate anything at all, which we all know is impossible anyway.
Barry has tweeted in at Newstalk FM or at Gav Riley, the easiest way to overcome the internet age problem we were talking about a few moments ago and to stop a minority from logging on while the majority have extra verification, etc., etc., would be to make the parents responsible for children's actions, you know, like they used to be in the old days. And I also see some reports that one of Boris Johnson's surrogates has been on BBC Five Live in the last hour and a half or so, Liz Truss. It was pointed out to her that the EU say that there will be no implementation period if there's no Brexit or no deal. And of course, Boris Johnson says we can sort out all of these things in the implementation period. And Liz Truss's response was, they would say that, wouldn't they? Which is, it's good to know that that's the high standard of political discourse that's still raging across the water.
The European exit polls, starting with Dublin, I suspect.
Starting with Dublin,
why not? Okay.
And the big surprise
that
here.
That is a big surprise.
Ciarán Cough of the Green Party way out ahead on top of the poll with 23%.
That's a big result. And an exit poll.
It is an exit poll.
I've saved you
it
the
money. Thank you very much.
Ryan Tuberty and David McCullough on the Late Late Show a couple of weeks ago, just after the polls had closed for the local and European elections. David McCullough adding the very prescient caveat that it was only an exit poll after Ryan had characterised it as a result. The reason why we play that, Gary Murphy, is because on page 2 of the Sunday Independent, Philip Ryan is reporting that a furious Fianna Fáil is set for a showdown with RTE over the exit poll, and specifically their concerns that it might have set a narrative which suggested that Fianna Fáil didn't win the elections, which of course they did.
Yeah, I mean, I know there's lots of clapping on the Late Late Show, but that was the first time I ever seen a clap for a poll, which is a bit odd. Maybe there was a few Green supporters there on the same night.
I think they'd done it for the two referendum exit polls, I think in 2015 and 18, but I'd never heard it for a person before.
But the thing about those referendums was they were carried by such overwhelming majorities anyway, and sort of the zeitgeist being for yes for both the same-sex marriage referendum and the repealing of the 8th Amendment.
But Fianna Fáil's grievance, they think that the exit poll underestimated the party's support for the local elections, and that therefore people who didn't pay attention to the actual results might have thought that Fianna Fáil did less well than they actually did.
Yeah, so I mean, it was the poll had Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael at 23% in the locals, whereas Fianna Fáil got 27% and Fine Gael got 25%. Now, 4% is quite a lot to be out by. Now, there is usually a 3% margin of error.
It was a big sample, so should only have been 2.
Pretty much so. You know, and now I have some sympathy. I obviously go on these shows and, you know, you're presented with a poll and obviously you're going to talk about a poll. I think Fianna Fáil's more fundamental point is why are they consistently being underestimated by Red Sea in particular.
Which is a bigger issue than just the exit poll, that it's an issue with pollsters' methodologies. It's not something that they ought to be complaining to RTE about editorialising.
Well, one would have thought not. And it might be a case for Fianna Fáil where people simply still aren't willing to admit that they actually voted for the old Soldiers of Destiny after the crash and the toxic nature of Fianna Fáil. Now, as I've said too on dozens of occasions, you know, Fianna Fáil were never going to die in this state. Their roots are simply too deep. They went down to, obviously, as we know,
no amount of Fine Gael Roundup will ever get rid of those roots.
and Fine Gael will be the same no matter how the next like Fine Gael were at a really low ebb, as we know, in 2002.
Yeah.
And then the Kenny came in and electrified or electrocuted the party, depending on what who one believes. But I have some sympathy in one way for RT. I'm not sure what basically they can do. You could say, well, there should be no exit polls, and then you talk about campaigns as you're waiting for tallies, or you go to tallies. And I mean, Lise was making the point earlier that there was very little tallies of the European elections in particular.
Yeah.
And we did know that the poll in Dublin was significantly out. For Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael as well.
It's quite out in Midlands North West as regards the Greens too.
Well, indeed. So,
although, yeah. Stephen O'Leary, you've been waiting very politely for the chance to plug some of your own work, because Michael Brennan has been reporting today in the Sunday Business Post that you didn't need an exit poll to discover that there was a green wave, because they could have just looked at your data anyway.
Yeah, well, to be fair, we didn't publish this data in advance, but we were approached by MKC in relation to doing a piece of research in the same way that Red Sea and other polling companies are approached. But obviously we do things in a slightly different way, that instead of asking questions, we just listen to what the general reaction to the content is online. And
so how could you diagnose there being a green wave before the exit poll had actually happened then?
Well, it's interesting. Much as we were looking at social media and the performance, particularly on the big three networks, Twitter, Facebook and Instagram, of each of the candidates in the European elections, it was a traditional media moment that was the real tipping point. So we saw the reaction online to the televised debate and particularly Saoirse McHugh's performance in that debate.
Yeah, and her confrontations against Peter Casey.
Yes, and it was the reaction online afterwards that was an indication to us that there was going to be a significant increase in support for the Green Party, because the volume of new followers in particular that she gained as a candidate in the immediate aftermath. So 7,000 new Twitter followers came behind her on the back of that individual piece. And that was just on Twitter, but there was an increase on Facebook, on Instagram. And we looked at something else too, which was a critical thing for us, and it was the level of engagement. So there were lots of candidates who talked lots, and there were lots of candidates who talked an awful lot during the campaign.
Sure.
But the candidates who had a longer tail, the candidates that had been talking and using these networks to share information and to canvass for, let's say, years in advance as opposed to weeks in advance in some cases, their levels of engagement were much higher. And if you look at the data that we analysed for this piece of research, it was the Green Party who enjoyed the greatest level of engagement with their content.
So is there a natural link then between the follower numbers and that level of engagement and your actual outcome at the polls? Is it possible to draw a direct line between them?
I think that's probably a little bit of a jump, but certainly as a signalling tool, it's a really, really effective way of doing it, because what it shows you is the message that you were sending out landing with the people you're trying to send it to. Mm. And certainly you could look at certain candidates who were being very vocal and were talking an awful lot and making an awful lot of noise, but the level of engagement with our message was very, very low. Whereas there were candidates who were talking less frequently, but when they did speak, they were generating quite high levels of engagement. And that correlation definitely bore out in terms of the results.
It's funny, actually, Gary, in the fallout of the elections being fully counted, and Lise, maybe you want to come in on this as well, that there seemed to be this backlash by some other political parties that when the final count was done and the Greens hadn't performed at the 18% that the exit poll had given them, and that they hadn't won seats everywhere, that people were like, this isn't a green wave, this is some sort of a green ripple. Whereas had there been no exit poll at all and the Greens had gone from 12 council seats to 49 and no European seats to 2, you'd have happily called it a green wave anyway, wouldn't you?
You would. At least I would anyway. I mean, the story of the election was the Green 2 seats in Dublin and in South. And I mean, concurrently with that, the demise of Sinn Féin. And I'd be interested in what Stephen's view in terms of Sinn Féin's online profile is, because it was always very strong. Whether that dissipated or not, I don't know.
Stephen,
but that was the story,
yeah, well,
really.
What, you know, a top-line overview of the data was that, again, they were extremely vocal. So I think Leanna Rita was actually topped the polls in terms of our ranking of people who were most active on some of the particular networks in terms of pushing out a message.
Although potentially because she had been running in an election 7 months before the Euros as well.
Potentially, but we only looked at the 3 months directly in advance of the election. So we actually took a much shorter time period in terms of the performance, because we knew there were some candidates who had just entered the race at that time, and we wanted the data to be fair. But what's critical is there often what gets confused is clients who are not clients, but individual politicians who are very active versus those whose message is landing.
And the Greens the Greens were all but killed off in 2011, yeah. after their dalliance with Fianna Fáil in government. So, I mean, that was a story, unquestionably.
But I think you're right. Gary's right to a point is that, you know, the other missed story was the demise of Sinn Féin. There's this sort of fairly spectacular drop in their vote. But I think it also showed as well just how much importance we do tend to put on tallying, because I spent the whole of Saturday in the RDS, and all the tallies that were been done there, I'd say maybe bar one or two, were all for the local elections, which of course the boxes were being sorted at the same time. And I was sort of trying to run around trying to get some kind of sense of what the European vote was. All I could see was immediately that the votes were going everywhere. They were going scattering in every which direction. But so you had that kind of double whammy of no tallying by people to give, to give commentators some kind of backup to see was the poll or steer to see was the poll right or wrong. So you ended up having all poor old political commentators like us sitting in studios everywhere, just going, well, according to the exit poll, not realising we were making monkeys.
Lise, can I stop you there and get you to talk about page 3 of the Sunday Times instead, please? Because there's excellent piece by Emily Sheehan that you wanted to mention, which is a study of how often people who sit in chairs like this one interrupt their guests.
Exactly. And it's a most entertaining piece. Yes, Emily Sheehan seemed to have done all this research. This seems to be a sort of a self-generated thing. Obviously, must have spent hours going through with the stopwatch. I know, actually, sort of timing how many people say, "May I interrupt you there?" And it's just very interesting. There's a table that shows the top interrupter is Mary Wilson, who presents Drive Time on RTE, followed by Brian Dobson on Morning Ireland. Ivan Yates, no surprise there. I would have actually thought he would have come in number one with a bullet, goes to show you. Anya Lawler, followed by Sean O'Rourke, Claire Byrne, Rachel English, Audrey Carville, Pat Kenny and Gavin Jennings,
interesting. Get on with it.
Yeah, but it's interesting. Yeah, I do indeed. It's actually five women versus five women, or five men. Kind of good to see the breakdown there. But I think what is interesting is it's the quality of the interruptions.
Yeah.
Particularly if you have a morning show, everything is very fast paced. If somebody is waffling any longer than 30 seconds, you've got to get in there and say, sorry, move on to the point. Whereas there are more discursive shows. And then also sometimes it is better to let somebody talk. We saw a classic example of the assassination interview was Sean O'Rourke interviewing Maria Bailey over the whole.
He didn't even need to ask questions. He just gave her the rope.
But he was also determined. He was also had the experience to do that. Sometimes interruptions are good because they get the interviewee back on track, particularly if it's a politician who knows how to talk down the clock. But of course, there are, and I have sat in studios with them, and I'm not naming any of them, but you're not one of them before I say it, presenters who like to show off and they like to say, I know more than you do, and like to interject their own opinion into something when really you should let the person talk. And they are out there.
Deeply ironically, we are now completely out of time, but I did want to allow you to finish that sentence just before I did have to come barreling in, lest I be accused of all sorts of inappropriate stuff. Thank you all for coming in this morning. It's been great to have you all. Lise Hand, political columnist, commentator, journalist at large, Hack for Hire, Professor Gary Murphy, who's the head of the political science at DCU, and Stephen O'Leary, who is from the online news and social media monitoring company, Olitico. Thank you all very much for coming in.